Insurgent Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network. Tom Metzger. Yeah, Terrible Tommy in the Heartland, in the bunker. Yeah, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern. We're ready to go here. We're going to put on another Frank Bauer monologue here and get you guys up to speed here. So we're going to get right into that. Remember, a P.O. Box 401. Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your mail to Tom Metzger, to the Insurgent, or simply to Box Holder. And make your checks or money orders to Tom Metzger, or the Insurgent, or to cash. Yeah, however you want to do it. So here's Frankie Boy.
Insurgency Radio calling. Insurgency 101 Radio calling. This is Frank Bauer. I'm back to do another spiel for you guys. I was thinking yesterday about the last show I did. I know I get excited. I start raising my voice. I don't want anyone out there to think that I'm talking down to people of the radio club. I'm not talking down to you guys at all. You guys are my comrades. You guys I would, you know, run through fire for, and I hope you would do the same for me. But I just get some things I just cannot control my emotions on. Like, you know, if you have a conversation with Tom Metzger and you start talking about the U.S. military just brutalizing people in other countries, that usually sets him off on a tirade. And when I talk about the cowardice of the white race or how we're not doing nothing in the face of all the things that are happening to us, you know, I'm just an angry guy, and I try to control my anger, but it's just, I guess I'm just really pissed off these days. So I don't want anyone out there to think that I'm talking down to you guys. You guys are the best. and I hope you're reading diligently on the subject of guerrilla warfare, insurgency, wars or battles fought by partisans. War to Flee is a great book, but I recommend you guys don't only read stuff on guerrilla warfare or insurgency. Get a hold of military manuals and read stuff on counterinsurgency. Find out what you're up against. Find out what kind of things that they'll use to neutralize you. We have to fight it totally different in this country from what we're reading. I'm reading these things as an example. They're not to be followed verbatim. They're just to spark ideas in your mind, because our thing, when it happens on this continent, which I hope it does, I don't even care if it starts in Canada, we got to do it totally different. So I encourage you guys to read anything on counterinsurgency, how our government trains special forces and stuff like that in counterinsurgency, okay? I'm going to finish off this this chapter here with, I believe it's deals with Mao Zedong and his lessons on War to Flee in China. Okay. Guerrillas can gain the initiative, writes Mao, if they keep in mind the weak points of the enemy. Remember, we don't want to compare our penises with anybody. We're not out to prove anything. We're not out to prove that our muscles are bigger or that we're more manly or whatever. There's nothing wrong with running away to live and fight another day. Okay? Keep in mind the weak points of the enemy. Because the enemy's insufficient manpower, guerrillas can operate over vast territories because the enemy is a foreigner and a barbarian. Well, that's not actually going to be the case with us. Our enemy is going to probably be homegrown right here, speaking perfect English, maybe even with a southern accent, maybe even with a New York or Boston accent. So, okay, guerrillas can gain the confidence of millions of their countrymen. I don't foresee that happening in my lifetime, but if it happens, great. All right. The reference was to the Japanese invader in China, and Mao makes it clear at all times that his laws of war were meant to apply specifically to China and the Chinese situation. What he says never, turning the page, nevertheless has more general application. For foreigner and barbarian, substitute oppressor and exploiter. There you go. That's our thing. Oppressor and exploiter. Those that want to exploit the white working class or send their jobs out of the country or whatever. Oppressor and exploiter, and the confidence which he speaks can be gained in many countries where no question of foreign intrusion arises. On tactics. In guerrilla warfare, select the tactics of seeming to come from the east and attacking from the west. Avoid the solid, attack the hollow. Attack, withdraw, semicolon, deliver a lightning blow, comma, seek a lightning decision. All right? Remember what I said about Erwin Rommel, economy of force. Also, I want to clarify something. Last show I talked about the acronym METT. It's the acronym that we use in the Army in the planning stages of an operation. Now these principles don't have to be applied against soldiers in uniform fighting under a banner. They can be used against hostile gang members. It's to organize your thinking for a military action. And I know Mr. Metzger said on a show that we don't have to do everything that the police does or the military. I think military tactics, I think we all need to know standard military tactics, whether they come from Britain, America, Russia, whatever. But METT stands for mission, your enemy, or your mission. Whatever you're going to do, you're going to raid, ambush, or recon. Enemy, who are you going to raid, ambush, or recon? Is it a bunch of gangbangers? Is it a foreign occupier? It can vary. It doesn't have to be used against military personnel. Okay. Mission, enemy, troops available. How many guys do you have to carry out the mission? Okay. Mission, enemy, troops available, terrain and weather. Now, it's under terrain and weather where I read the acronym ACOCA, observation and fields of fire, cover and concealment, obstacles, key terrain, and avenues of approach. These things have to be taken into consideration when you're doing anything. And even if you're doing a quintessential lone wolf op, you're the only guy. You've got to know how to use the terrain. If your avenue of approach to an objective is using streets, you're probably going to get caught on your egress out of the area. You got to know how to use the terrain, you know. And a good study of maps and satellite photos of a particular area. I've mentioned on shows before, when I recon an area, first thing I do, I go to Google. And, for example, I type in Evansville, Indiana, and map of Evansville, Indiana, in the Google search box. Then it comes up. And under Google Maps, I'll click on that, and it'll give me a map of Evansville. But I also have selections off to the upper right-hand corner, whether I want satellite, hybrid, or map, or street view. I always have problems with the street view, but I always go with satellite, and I zoom in as low as I can. Some areas in the country won't let you zoom in, but any less than 1,000 feet, some of them 2,000 feet, so those aren't really helpful. But I've looked, you know, all over Chicago. I've looked at certain cities in Indiana and Des Moines and whatever, and you can really zoom in and see how the streets flow and see what buildings are where and what parking lots are where and where, you know, and once you get your map called up, you have it on satellite, you zoom in, and then the upper left-hand corner search box, you type in apartments in Evansville, Indiana, and it gives you a whole list of them on the side with numbers, and then these numbers correspond to the numbers that pop up on the map. You got to know how to use the terrain, mission, enemy, troops available, terrain and weather, and time. How much time do you need to accomplish it? When do you need to initiate the mission? When does it need to be terminated by? You don't want to be escaping and evading when the sun's coming up. You want to be back home doing your after-action review or debriefing your commander or maybe debriefing your comrades right when the sun's coming up. So just some things to think about. Okay. On politics, without a political goal, guerrilla warfare must fail, as it must if political objectives do not coincide with the aspirations of the people, and their sympathy, cooperation, and assistance cannot be gained. The essence of guerrilla warfare is thus political in character. Yeah, I totally agree with that, but I think I liked what I read in the Turner Diaries, what I told you guys about on the last show, that, you know, maybe we need to consider the white masses out there who don't give a damn about the survival of the white race, who are going on with their merry lives while our race is being destroyed. Maybe we need to consider them as hostile. You know, maybe we need to create a atmosphere in this country where they fear us more than they fear the system. You know, you go to YouTube and type in any one of these NSM rallies in Kalamazoo or Lansing or Toledo. They don't fear us. We have police protection around us. You know, I know you've heard Tom Mesko talk about this numerous times. We look like clowns. We look like weak, you know, spineless, shit-talking people. This does not look good. We need to fly under the radar. We need to be so covert that we could show up at a demonstration against racism, and we need to be ones that are cheering, down with these damn racists. Kill all these racists or down with racism. You know, like when Tom Mesker went to that one demonstration once and wearing a yarmulke portraying a Jewish rabbi. That, I mean, we need to do ballsy shit like that if we're going to be have any kind of success in the future. What does it say? Victory goes to the bold, or I forgot how that saying went. But you're not going to gain anything if you don't initiate anything. Okay, on the other hand, in a war of counter-revolutionary nature, there's no place for guerrilla hostilities. What? On the other hand, in a war of counter-revolutionary nature, there's no place for guerrilla hostilities. okay, that would totally fall in line with us, counter-revolutionary. I mean, the system is just so huge and seemingly ubiquitous and seemingly just all-knowing. So operating, I really feel that operating in a group over five, you're really pushing it. So remember, if you have a group of five, and you don't have, like, maybe you have the most charismatic leader of the five who's maybe like the leader, but everybody pulls their weight. In a way, for a leader, if you want to be a leader in the struggle, you have to abide by the three M's. As a good leader, you got to put the mission first. Take care of the mission. What's the mission? The next M, you got to take care of your men. Your men's welfare comes before yours. And then you take care of me. So if you follow those three M's in that order, you're going to be a successful leader in this struggle. Take care of the mission, then take care of your men, then take care of yourself. Mission, men, and me in that order. Okay. Because guerrilla warfare basically derives from the masses and is supported by them. It can neither exist nor flourish if it separates itself from their sympathies and cooperation. You know, I've said this before, and I'm sure I'll say it again 100 times before I'm either kicked off this show, or I either move someplace, or either I decide to travel about the countryside taking pictures of mountains or whatever. I will always say this until I'm blue in the face, and that is that, you know, if we don't have any kind of balls and initiate something that's going to, you know, not really get the attention of the people, but show people that we're no joke. And the best example I can give of that is the order. You know, I sometimes wonder if the order just didn't go recruiting, how far could they have gone? But I would suggest keeping your operation small, not looking for popular support, because we're not going to get it. And it says that it can either flourish if it separates itself from the sympathies. You know what? We don't want the sympathies of the masses. You know, if we won them over, what would we do with them? They'd be bickering and fighting, tearing your whole operation apart. We don't want the masses. We want the 1-2% of these hardcore guys. And if you have just a group of guys, you know, if you have just four friends that believe what you believe in, you don't need anything else. You don't need the approval of Tom Metzger or myself. You guys decide within yourself and your own little circle of influence there what needs to be done. You don't got to contact anyone. You definitely don't want to brag in a bar or brag on some blogging space about stuff you're doing. Stop looking for credit. Don't look for credit. You're not going to get it. You don't want credit, because if you start getting credit, someone's going to sell you out. So, don't look for popular support. Mao's rules for conduct of guerrilla warfare are rhetorical, redundant, and often less precise than one might wish. They leave many practical questions unanswered. It is to be remembered that he was writing political documents, not a text for insurgents. His collective works remain nonetheless the primer of guerrilla theory and the study of his campaigns, which ended with the destruction and defeat of an army of 3,700,000 men, the greatest in Chinese history, reveals much that is relevant elsewhere in countries which, like China, lack arms and industry, but do not lack the basic ingredients of revolutionary war: space, time, and will. And I hope you guys remember how or what I said about that. But like I said before, you don't have to model yourselves after Mao or Che Guevara. You know, learn read what they say and apply it to your own thing. Like, look at Iraq. The closest example in history that what's going on in Iraq is what the insurgents did against the French in Algeria. That's the best example I can come up with. Now, that's the end of that chapter. I want to read some things from WASP. I want to see if I can get some some useful things here. Like I said, I'm going to be, you know, you're not going to get the whole gist of the story. I hope you guys ain't so tight-fisted with your money that you can't contact WAR and get a copy of this. You know, $20 post-paid. I mean, you can get a copy of this, and it's entertaining. But, you know, there is some interesting things in it. And I can give you all the things that pertain that I think are interesting, but you can get something totally different out of it. You can read the same book and come up with a different idea that you need to share with us. You know, I'm glad we got computer guy coming on Tom's show. I'm glad we got the Lone Wolf California guy. And then there's me. There's three. I mean, come on, guys. I mean, if you don't want your voice on the radio, you can easily email something, a good idea to Tom Metzger from a public library, and he can read it on the show. All you guys got something to give us. All you guys, every single swinging Richard out there can come up with something that we can use. Okay, let's check in on our buddy James Mowry, who's a WASP on a Sirian planet that is orbiting the sun in the sun in the Sirius constellation or whatever it's called. It's another planet. For the rest of the evening, his exploration of Pertang, which is a city on this planet, was not as haphazard as it looked. He wandered around memorizing all geographical features that might prove useful to recall later on. But primarily, he was seeking to estimate the climate of public opinion with particular reference to minority opinions. Can you imagine a couple guys, a little small group of guys, relocating from Seattle to Cincinnati? Not talking about any racial views at all, just keeping yourselves low-key. If you go on any kind of mission like that, you want to have it so when somebody meets you on the street, they forget about you 10 minutes later. If you're wearing flashy clothes, if you got tattoos all over your arms, or if you say some bizarre shit or some radical stuff, if you go on a mission like this, if you want to be a WASP in another U.S. city or a city in England or Germany or wherever, you can't stand out. You got to blend in. You got to be as bland as possible. You're not there to proselytize. The only proselytizing you should be doing is like what this James Mowry guy is doing. He's basically has the police force on this planet in an uproar thinking that there's a revolutionary movement going on their planet, and it doesn't exist. He comes to this planet, he starts to distributing literature, saying that the system will be destroyed mercilessly and brutally by this revolutionary movement that doesn't even exist. The police force are chasing figments of the imagination of James Mowry, and that could be done anywhere. Okay. Minority opinions. I mean, you can go somewhere and stir up, let's say if you was to relocate to Appleton, Wisconsin, which has a very high Hmong population, so much so that they're forming Asian gangs up there. You can go up there, pretend to be a Wisconsinite, and maybe do something to inflame them. Set them off. Get them rioting in the streets. Yeah, but for you federal people listening to that show, that's only for if the country becomes occupied by Chinese soldiers. There you go. Okay, there's always the minority that oppresses or opposes a war for such reasons as reluctance to make necessary sacrifices, fear of personal loss or suffering, and philosophical and ethical objection to warfare as a method of settling disputes. Then there's lack of confidence in the ability of the leadership, resentment at being called upon to play a subordinate role, pessimistic belief that victory is far from certain and defeat very possible, egotistic satisfaction of refusing to run with the herd, and psychological opposition to being yelled at on any and every petty pretext and a thousand other reasons. A WASP could make good use of all those who would not heed the bugle call. nor follow the beat of the drum. Indeed, even if it proved impossible to trace any such persons and employ them individually, Maori still could still exploit the fact of their existence. Going on, it says, and a couple paragraphs down, it says, yes, these, the objectors, the selfish, the greedy, the resentful, the conceited, the moral cowards, and the criminals could all be utilized for his purposes, meaning Maori's. Like I said, I hope I didn't read this, but maybe, you know, let's not totally discount people who shout 14 words, you know, that maybe have a criminal thing going on. You know, I believe there's some organization called P&I, I'm not sure. They're like neo-Nazis, but they're like criminals or something, and they're a criminal-based organization. I'm not sure. You guys know more about that maybe than I would. Then there's Nazi lowriders. You know, they say that they're neo-Nazis. They say they believe in 14 words, and they're a gang, but they're down with the southern Mexicans, you know, with the Sereños, which is the street army of the Mexican mafia. You know, and then there's the Aryan Brotherhood. I mean, they're definitely involved in drug trafficking and stuff like that. We don't want to bust heads with these guys or not throw hands at each other, meaning get in fist fights with them. We can use any white organization to our whatever, you know. I mean, we're definitely not going to use someone like Glenn Beck or his minions. We're not going to use someone like Rush Limbaugh. We're not going to use Harold Covington or Glenn Miller. We're not going to use anyone like that. We need to use people as like what Khrushchev used to consider communists living in America. He used to call them useful idiots. And not to say that Aryan Brotherhood or Nazi lowriders are useful idiots, but they could help us. I mean, they could be temporary allies. And then when we win this thing, we can go our separate ways, you know. So let's not close our doors to anyone, even if they got tattoos, Nazi tattoos tattooed on their face. Obviously, they can't be lone wolf, but we can stir them up, maybe. Okay. When one man is playing the part of an invading army, the essential thing is to move fast. Make full use of any and every opportunity. Waste no effort. James Maori had to travel about the city to find a better hideout. It was equally necessary to go hither and thither to make the first moves in this game, so he combined the two purposes. Meaning, while he was reconning another hideout, he was distributing this literature about this fictitious revolutionary organization that's going to, you know, tear apart the government. Okay. The sticker said in bold, easily readable print, "War makes wealth for the few, misery for the many." At the right time, Dirac and Gaston Gessept, which is the name of the revolutionary organization, from now on I'll refer to them as the DAG. It says that the DAG will punish the former and bring aid and comfort to the latter. It was sheer luck that he arrived coincidentally with a big boost in the war tax. Very likely that readers would feel sufficiently aggrieved not to tear the sticker down in patriotic fury. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things going on in the news that we can exploit. You know, I mean, we can maybe come up with racist flyers about Barack Obama and somehow get them in the black or racially mixed communities to add to the tension, create tension. We're WASP. We're known for fucking shit up, okay? Every single one of you listening out there has power. No, you don't have economic power, military power, media power, business power. You don't have, I don't know if I said it, political power. Everyone who's a member of the Radio Club or Resist.com has only one form of power, and that's disruptive power. So be the WASP, but don't be it in the community in which you live. Don't be the WASP in the community in which you work. be the wasp in a community that nobody can tie you to. Okay. I have to turn the page here and find some stuff that I marked out. So there may be little lulls in our time together here. Oh, I got a big passage to read here. Oh, here it goes. That was the kind of chance that must be taken when one holds up and known or regularly checked haunts. Basically, I don't want to read the whole thing, but basically, if you're not being hide out anywhere, you need to keep a low profile and try not to be noticed by anybody. Okay, last word that says, the risk was not enormous. In fact, it was small, but it was still there. And when tried, sentenced, and waiting for death, it is no consolation to know that what came off was 100-to-1 chance. If Maori was to maintain the one-man battle, the enemy had to be outwitted all along the line all the time. Satisfied that by now the most persistent of snoops could not follow his torturous trail through the city. This guy, when he went on either looking for a hideout or maybe to make sure that he wasn't tailed at all, he would go on this real elaborate, get on a bus here, get off a bus there, and go, walk up this street, turn up an alley to catch another bus. It would be very confusing to follow this guy, but that's, what's got to be done. Satisfied that by now persistent snoops could not follow his torturous trail through the city, Maori retrieved his case, carried it up to the third floor. See, he didn't take his case of his bag of tricks to where he had his hideout. He hid it first and then made sure that the coast was clear or whatnot. Okay. Retrieved his case, carried it up to the third floor of the ramshackle tenement building and let himself into his suite of two sour-smelling rooms. The rest of the day he spent cleaning the place and making it fit for habitation. He'd be much harder to trace here. The shifty-eyed landlord had not asked to see his identity card and accepted him without question as Gast Hurkin, Gasthurkin. Frank Bauer is dead. Gast Hurkin is resurrected in his place. A low-grade railroad official, honest, hard-working, and stupid enough to pay his rent regularly on time, speaking of himself. So the landlord don't ask questions because he's always on time with the rent. He doesn't draw attention to himself. To the landlord's way of thinking, the unsavory neighbors rated a higher IQ in terms of their environment, being able to get by with less effort. So the landlord thought, most of the people I deal with want to shaft me on rent or money owed me. This guy, Gas Hurkin, he pays everything on time. What a dumbass. That's the landlord's attitude. But he doesn't complain because he's got the money. And what money's he got? Counterfeit money. Housework finished. Maori bought a paper and searched for it for some mention of yesterday's activities. There wasn't one on the subject. At first he felt disappointed. Then on further reflection he became heartened. Opposition to the war and open defiance of the government definitely made news that justified a front page spread. No reporter, no editor would pass it up if he could help it. Therefore, the papers had passed it up because they could not help it. Somewhere high in authority had clamped down upon them and with a heavy hand of censorship. Somebody with considerable power and had been driven into making a weak countermove. That was a start anyway. Maori's first waspish buzzings had forced authority to interfere with the press. What's more, the countermove was feeble and ineffective, serving only as a stopgap while officials beat their brains for more decisive measures. Okay. The more persistently the government maintains silence on a given subject of discussion, the more the public talks about it and thinks about it. I hope that's true. The longer and more stubborn the silence, the guiltier the government looks to the talkers and thinkers. In time of war, the most morale-lowering question that can be asked is, what are they hiding from us? What are you hiding from us, Bush? What are you hiding from us, Chuck Schumer? Anti-gun bastard, but yet you got armed guards, and I'm sure you got guns in your house. Fucking faggot. Anyways, where to, asked the taxi driver. Can't tell you exactly, Mallory said evasively. I've been here only once before, and that was years ago. But I know the way. Just follow my instructions. The taxi car set up a rising hum as the machine sped down the road. While its passenger kept attention on the car ahead, Mallory's following another car, but he doesn't want to tell the taxi driver, hey, follow that car, because if anything goes down, the taxi driver could make a connection between Mallory following that, telling the taxi driver to follow that car and something that happened to that car. So you don't want to stand out in anyone's mind. He's having the taxi cab driver follow this other car without this taxi cab driver knowing he's following someone else. He just, you know, when he sees the car speed ahead, he goes, oh, yeah, make a right up here or left up here. Okay. While his passengers kept attention on the car ahead and gave curt orders from time to time, it would have been lots easier, he knew, to have pointed and said, follow that green car. But that would have linked him in the driver's mind with the major. He's following a major of the secret police, by the way. Or at least with the major's green car. The secret police were experts at ferreting out such links and following them to the bitter end. As it was, the taxi driver had no idea he was shadowing anyone. Pretty good ideas. It said, a power lover... Oh, there's another flyer that DAG put out. The flyer said, power lovers started the war. DAG will end it. And them. Threats from a fictitious organization. Got the secret police running all over the place, interrogating people who have absolutely nothing to do with it. Okay. There came no rush of feet toward the apartment. Mallory just assassinated the major of the secret police. Don't use this as excuse not to. You guys need to buy this book and read it. Nobody raced away yelling for help. If anyone had heard, turning the page, heard the muffled shots, muffled bursts of shots, they would have attributed the noise to the flow of traffic far below. Going down further on the page, it said there was a broad hint to the powers that be that somebody was willing and able to do more than talk. The wasp had done plenty of buzzing around. Now it had demonstrated its sting. So far, with the exception of a few, all we do is talk. You know, I was thinking the other day, I mean, you know, Matt Hale, he's a very intelligent guy, very articulate. I've seen many interviews on him on TV, not on TV, but on YouTube that he gave on TV, and just like, wow, what a great guy, you know? And we spent all this time trying to get respect for people. I'm not saying Matt Hale was wrong, that's just the way he operated. I just really wish he would have done something different, because Matt Hale out of jail is more value to us than Matt Hale in jail, so, or in prison. But yeah, I know I talked about this on the last show, but we need to stop trying to get respect of people. We need to have them respect us out of fear, not out of, you know, just casual respect you would show somebody on the street. You know, We need to be people of action, politics of the deed. Okay, alternatively, he could try bluff by marching straight up to the biggest and ugliest of them, shoving the case in. Okay, let you know what's going on. Mallory's on this bus or something, and he has a case that if the secret police asked to search his case, he would be caught red-handed. What he could do is say, hey, this case was left on a seat by me, taking it up to the secret police on the bus. Say, hey, this thing was left by me. I don't know what to make of it, but I remember the guy that was sitting here was a tall, lanky guy. I mean, you could do that to try to avoid suspicion. So I think that's what happened before that. But let's read on. See, the biggest and ugliest, I'm shoving a case into his hand and saying, with dopey eagerness, pardon me, officer, one of those fellows who just went through dropped this in front of me. I can't imagine why he abandoned his luggage. Then somewhere in resulting chaos, there would be a chase for him to amble around the corner and run as if jet-propelled, basically to send the police off on a wild goose chase so he can get away. He was sweaty with reaction when he found his fears were not confirmed, because he thought, I guess, he was going to be searched. This had been the first murder. Oh, that's right. He's coming away from the murder of the major, and he took a bunch of secret files from the major's apartment. So he wants to use them to glean information from them. But ran into some secret police, and he thought the secret police would search him. So he already had a cover story cooked up. Always have a cover story before you drive out to do any kind of op. Have your cover story, just in case you're pulled over by a police. You know, you can have a fictitious address written on a piece of paper. You get pulled over, and the cop says, what are you doing in this area? And you say, man, I'm looking for this house. I was told this guy's got a guitar for sale, but I can't find this house anywhere. And even if the police would walk you up to the house, you could say, hey, I hear you got a guitar for sale. The guy's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, damn, man, somebody gave me some false information. I mean, always have a cover story cooked up, okay? This had been his first murder, and it was a murder because they would define it as such. So he'd been paying for it in his own imagination, fancying himself hunted before the hunt was on. Beyond the barrier lounged two station police, eyeing the emerging stream with total lack of interest and yawning from time to time. He went past practically under their noses, and they could not have cared less about him. But Maori wasn't off the hook yet. Police at the station expected to see people carrying luggage any time of the day or night. Cops in the cities were inclined to question the reason at such an hour. You know, when we do stuff, I guess because we're so programmed by the system's laws and their list of thou shall nots, that if we break any one of them, we just think we're being hunted right now and right there. And I remember a guy telling me when he killed his first guy in Vietnam, he just felt like he was going to be judged by God at any second now. And then he noticed after he killed his second and third and fourth that no voice boomed from heaven saying, you are condemned forever into the pit of hell. You know, no punishment came. We really condemn ourselves. And I heard someone say one time, the reason why there's so many people in the insane asylums is because they don't know how to deal with, or they refuse to take responsibility for certain actions, and that causes mental problems. And I remember the movie The Last Samurai with Tom Cruise. Remember when Tom Cruise is being kind of won over by the samurai, they're building good friendship or whatever, and they're in that garden of blossoms, and Japanese samurai is trying to write a poem about blossoms and about the cycle of life. And, Tom Cruise's character says, yeah, I've seen many things in battle. I've done many things. And a Japanese guy said something to the effect of, you're haunted by them only because you feel guilty for what you've done. But we're warriors, and men like us see bad things, but they only bother you if you feel guilty about them. Remember, in this struggle of ours, we have the moral high ground. You know, too many of us get shouted down by liberals and social Marxists, and we get intimidated. I've seen it on that video at YouTube, but Look Who's Talking, when Tom Metzger was on stage with faggot-ass Tom Martinez, who deserves a bullet. He's on stage with him and a bunch of skinheads in the audience, and it seemed like the minute they put a microphone in front of one of them, they couldn't talk no more. Come on, guys. I mean, just, you know, I was in this Christian group, this Christian church. We had our church published a book called Prepare to Answer, and it's based off of some scripture in 2 Peter about we always need to be prepared to give an answer for our faith. Well, you know what? I don't believe in Christianity, but I think that's a good philosophy for us to have. We need to be prepared to give an answer why things are the way they are. Renee says, what makes you think white people are better than black people? You know, point out the obvious. You know, say, watch the news. And they'll say, well, that's all that crime's attributed to the poor because black people are poor in the ghetto. I'm like, you can easily say in return to that or in response to that, there are plenty of poor white people in the Blue Ridge Mountains. There are thousands and thousands of poor white people in Appalachia. You don't hear about them doing drive-bys and offing each other in record numbers. Be prepared to give an answer. Okay. I'm trying to know where I should pick up reading here. Not that I noticed. It seemed all right to me. It wasn't a native Jimican, I think was the name of the city. Jimic was the name of the city. So someone from Jimic would be called Jimican, though. Spoke with a Mashabi growl. That's Maori. He can fake this accent really well. Remember where you took him? Yes, I do. I can show you. There was a way out of this. What I just read there, that's the thing that Maori's thinking in his head about how people can finger him or how maybe if they saw him walking away from a phone booth after giving a threatening message to the system that somebody could spot him. If somebody's watching you, if somebody's watching you, don't stare right back at him. That's only going to confirm his suspicion. If somebody's really watching you, glance over in his direction. But if someone's really taking careful notice of you, go about yourself with casual confidence, like you have every right to be where you are. You have every right to be doing what you're doing. Casual confidence. Maybe glance in the direction a couple of times. Don't stare at them because that's going to confirm that something, and it also can make you stand out in his mind even more. Somebody's watching you really close, abort the mission or wait until he's gone or whatever. Okay, there was a way out of this predicament. Maori took it by putting the case in a rented locker at the station and walking away. In theory, the case would be safe enough for one full day. In fact, there was a chance of its being discovered and used as bait. Now, if you put something in a locker, you hide something in a locker, and if you need to retrieve it later, that thing may have been found by the authorities, but they left it in there and they're watching the locker by undercover agents or whatever, waiting for you to pick it up. So always keep that in mind. You know, a good ruse to use, rent the movie Get Shorty with John Travolta. John Travolta wanted to check out something that was in a locker at a either train station or plane station. And he knew that security was watching that locker. So he developed a ruse. He rented a locker next to it, and he had the key for the locker that had the money in it or whatever. Just I don't want to use the telephone time to talk about this, but rent the movie Get Shorty. Pay particular attention to how John Travolta wanted to check out the security of this locker at the airport. It's he had a really good idea for something like that. Okay. Where am I? Our resume off the hook. Cops in the city were inclined to question the okay. We already talked about the locker. Let me turn the page here and find something else to read. Okay, at noon, Maori returned to the station cautiously and stood around for 20 minutes as if waiting to meet an incoming traveler. He kept careful watch in all directions while appearing interested in nothing save a casual streams of arrivals. Think about that. He kept careful watch in all directions while appearing interested in nothing. You know, people get given away, just like Chevy Kehoe and Shane Kehoe. They were pulled over, and if you don't know who they are, Google them. They were white patriots also. Google them if you have to. They were pulled over by the cops because when they were driving by the cops, they both stiffened up real stiff, and like they had that frightened look on their face. And when the vehicle passed by the squad car, first of all, the cop noticed him because he noticed him. When they noticed him, they stiffened up. They got all nervous. He could see it in their face. He could see it in their body movement or whatever. And when the truck, the SUV passed by the cop car, he saw Shane Kehoe nervously glance back at the cop. Cops are trained to look for shit like that. Carry about yourself with casual confidence, watching in all directions, but seemingly interested in nothing. This author's name, Eric Frank Russell. Someone find out about this guy. I mean, what, did he work for FBI or CIA or something? Okay, the secret police were not the kind to alarm a gang by grabbing one member. They preferred to bide their time and take the lot. So during the ride, he peered repeatedly backward, observed passengers getting off and on. I don't remember if that was a train or a bus. And tried to see if he could spot a loaded car tagging along somewhere behind. He changed buses five times, detoured through two squalid alleys, and walked up the fronts and out the backs of three department stores. Okay, he's trying to shake a potential tail. You know, nothing wrong with being cautious. Going out again, he bought a box of envelopes and a cheap typewriter. Then using the secret police paper, remember, he got the secret police papers from the major he assassinated. He spent the rest of the day and part of the next one typing with forceful brevity. He didn't have to bother about leaving his prints all over the correspondence. I guess they did something to his fingerprints, and they whenever he left a fingerprint on something, it looked unclassifiably blotchy and vague. So, I wonder if you can do something with your fingerprints like that to yourself, maybe with some kind of acid or something. All right. That done, he burned the envelope box and dropped the typewriter in the river where it ran deep. If Maury had occasion to write any more letters, he'd buy another typewriter and then get rid of it the same way. He could well afford to buy and scrap 100 typewriters if he thought it necessary. The more, the merrier. If the secret police analyzed the type of threatening correspondence and found a number of untraceable machines being used, he'd get the idea, or they would get the idea, that a gigantic organization was at work, because they're analyzing the type of all these papers, and it's all different. Furthermore, his every purchase helped inflate the Jamaican economy with worthless paper. It almost looks like the word Jamaican, but not quite. Okay, the villages were far more worse to handle. The smaller in size, the more troublesome they proved. In a city of 250,000 to 2 million population, a stranger is an insignificant non-entity. In a hamlet of less than 1,000 inhabitants, he is noticed, remarked upon, and his every move watched. Remember that. That is good stuff right there. Maury had been on Jimek exactly 4 weeks when he disposed of the last of the stickers from his bag and thus reached the end of Phase 1. Phase 1 was dissemination of propaganda. I think I'm going to stop right there, but I got a bunch of stuff highlighted in this book. Wasp is a great book. You guys need to be reading it. Don't be cheapskates. Buy your own copy. Refer to it. Next time we get together, I want to finish Wasp, but I also want to touch on the beginning of Chapter 5. That's Colonial War and the French Experience, strategies and tactics of the Nguyen Giep. I guess that was the Vietnamese leader, and how the Viet Minh won in Indochina. So, that should be interesting. But you guys, hope you're getting something out of this. Like I said, read stuff on counterinsurgency. You guys need to be reading. I'm going to say this on Blue in the Face. If you want to read stuff on National Socialism, you know, I guess Mein Kampf's all right, but maybe you should be reading Otto von Strasser, or maybe my favorite National Socialist author is by far William Joyce. I mean, the guy is a phenomenal writer. So this is Gast Herkin signing off. Frank Bauer is dead. And incidentally, I was listening to Tom Metzger's August 30th show, and he was playing some messages on from the answer machine, and there was a girl who called up, a white woman, who seemed really radical. She's like, I'm sick and tired of these niggers and this and that, and I don't have no problem, you know, standing up to any of them. I just want to know, if that female is out there listening to these shows, please contact me at blackhoodedsaxon@hotmail.com, because you seem like my kind of girl. And if you're married, well, I don't want to interfere with that. But let me depart with a couple of jokes. Joke number one, why are monkeys always frowning? Because they know in a million years they're going to be niggers. How does an Asian couple, how does an Asian man and wife name their children? They throw silverware down concrete steps. Ching, pong, kang, chong. I heard that last night. I was dying. How was copper wire invented? Two Jews fighting over a penny. Good stuff, huh? What do you call a bunch of white guys sitting on a bench? The NBA. So I think I covered all groups there. But you guys, worse is better for now, and 14 words, and fight the powers that be. 88-14.
Hi, I'm from the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and thank you for having us on this call. I've spoken with people like Michael Adler, others of your supporters who talk about you as a longtime supporter of Israel. On the other hand, the Republican Jewish Coalition is putting out lists of votes you've taken that have diverged from what AIPAC has recommended, most recently in the Kyle Lieberman case. So this was an amendment strongly supported by AIPAC, by the pro-Israel lobby. How do you reconcile, you know, being a strong supporter from Israel, of Israel, and also sometimes diverging from what the conventional wisdom is?
AIPAC does not speak for the entire American Jewish community. There's other organizations as strong and as consequential, number one. Number two, AIPAC does not speak for the state of Israel, no matter what it insists on occasion. Number three, the vast majority, I've never disagreed with AIPAC on the objective. Whenever I've had a disagreement with AIPAC, it has always been a tactical disagreement, not a substantive disagreement to what AIPAC has the tendency, like other organizations do, of thinking they know the Senate better than I do. They don't know the Senate better than I do, and they don't know how to get things done in the Senate better than I do. We have never been in a position where we've been at odds on the principle relating to Israel. And as far back as 1980 and before, I've received awards from the National Jewish Fund in 84. I got the Justice Louis C. Brandeis Award by the Zionist Organization of Baltimore, and in 1998, Bibi presented me the Asha Torah award in Israel for my strong support for Israel. You know, while all these guys were talking about what they're doing, ask AIPAC, who was the only guy, one of the few guys, if not the only guy, in 1980. To defend Israel's use of cluster bombs to defend themselves when they went in. I mean, so there's a whole lot of things that, back as recently as 2006, I was an original co-sponsor along with Mitch McConnell, of the Palestinian Anti-Terrorism Act of 2006 with banned assistance. So I take a backseat to no one, including AIPAC. No one, including AIPAC. Never has there been any divergence on what, in fact, we want to do for Israel. Now, on Kyle Lieberman, the administration already had the power to designate. I mean, this was gratuitous. The administration already had the power to designate as a terrorist organization, the Quds Force. They didn't need any authority. This is what I mean about tactics, the differences. And I opposed Kyle Lieberman because it opened the door to an attack on Iran at a time when I didn't trust this administration using that as a pretext to attack Iran when they could already without any congressional authority do exactly what Kyle Lieberman gave them the power to do. What I was worried about, because I've watched how they misused the authority we gave them with regard to Iraq, that they would misuse that authority. They would try to convolute this, the Kyle Lieberman bill, into saying that the Congress went on record as going into an attack on Iran. And, you know, so, you know, the fact of the matter is that at the time, you know, look, we had 140,000 troops bogged down in Iraq. And, you know, so the bottom line here is that because this opened the door to an attack on Iran, at the time we were bogged down in Iraq, and because I have been so stunned by the incompetence of this administration, of the conduct of the war until recently in Iraq, I wasn't about to give them a pretext to be able to go to war. And look, folks, you know this administration. You may have think they should have, but they misused the authority we gave them in 2002, and they misused the Iraq Liberation Act, and I feared they'd do the exact same thing. But this is back to my point. It was about tactics. It wasn't about whether the Quds Force is a terrorist organization. For God's sake, it is. I mean,